So I am going to be speaking from a text that, if you're someone who has hung around churches for any amount of time, you've probably heard before. And even if you haven't hung around churches very much, you may have heard before. My hope is that I left a bottle of water somewhere over here. A blue bottle of water. Awesome. My hope is that the fact that you've heard it before will not cause you to ignore what I'm about to say, but will actually give you some reason to listen in. Hopefully we can kind of hear afresh from this story of the Good Samaritan. And so what I want to do is I just want to jump in and read this. All the way down. It's not that long. And Caleb, this always happens to me. Can you just turn this a little bit down? I just feel like I have a like a leprechaun echoing me a little bit. Just very high. So what I want to do is I want to read this story, and then I want to think together a little bit about some of the ways that it has implications for us here at ECV, and the ways that it will help us think about what it means to be a community of love. What's the scope of kind of a community of love? But let's just kind of jump right in. So it begins this way. Just then, a lawyer stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he said, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said to him, "What is written in the law? What do you read there?" He answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have given the right answer. Do this, and you will live." But wanting to justify himself, the lawyer asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And Jesus replied with a story. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers, who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, while traveling, came near him, and when he saw him, he was moved with pity. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, having poured oil and wine on them. Then he put him on his own animal, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, "Take care of him, and when I come back, I will repay you whatever more you spend." Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? The lawyer answered, "The one who showed him mercy." Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." So it begins with this question from the lawyer. Who is my neighbor? And I want to suggest that even though the text says that this question is asked as for the sake of self-justification, and even though even if that is the reason, I think nevertheless it's a pretty good question. Who is my neighbor? Love your neighbor as yourself. It's kind of a tricky word, and it's interesting even in English we use this word neighbor. It's a little bit odd. You mean the people that live next door? What do you mean? The 2 words here, this is the only time you'll see Greek or Hebrew today, so fear not. Either of these words is kind of rea in Hebrew, the plesion in Greek. They have a large range of meanings, and especially rea, which is kind of the word that stands the furthest, the oldest kind of in this text, has a really large range of meanings, all the way from kind of friend, like sometimes like used in parallel with like an intimate lover on the one hand, and sometimes on the other just other, right? So on the one extreme, it can be synonymous with kind of friend, brother, closest relation. In some cases, it actually seems, on that end, it seems to mean something like fellow citizen or countryman. It's especially the case in places in the Hebrew Bible where one's rea is one's fellow Israelite, where the ethical appeal to kind of follow the law is based on some kind of appeal to like a brotherhood or a sisterhood. Like, don't rip off this guy. Don't rip off your neighbor. This is kind of similar to what we were talking about a couple weeks ago in Nehemiah. Don't go selling these folks into slavery. We have another like group over here working to free our brothers and sisters from slavery. So why make work? Love your neighbor in a very kind of specific sense. It would not make sense to operate against one's neighbor in that sense. On the other extreme, that simple word can just mean other, as in there's kind of this Hebrew idiom. If you just kind of said, like, each of them, you would say, each and his rea. Like, that could be just two people walking along in pairs, each with his rea. Or, you're going to lose your kingdom, and your rea, like another person, very much not your friend, that's the whole point, is going to take over, right? Not such a loss if your dear friend takes over your kingdom, a bigger loss of just someone else. And sometimes you literally mean like your opposite, your enemy, like the person, they went into battle and each fought the one opposite him, his rea. So the two possible meanings for this word suggest two very different ways of understanding the command to love our neighbors. Two different ways of thinking about whom we ought to love and how we ought to do that. I think this is significant because as people who presumably we would agree here, we want to like love people. This is perhaps a goal, whether or not your thoughts are about God, presumably we want to be good people. We want to love people. And I think that these two different kind of extremes, as it were, get at two different ways of thinking about what it means to love folks around us and kind of who that's supposed to be and how we're supposed to love them. If we take neighbor to mean friend, then we get a particular way of thinking about this. If we take neighbor to mean friend, fellow citizen, or countryman, then we expect the scope of love of neighbor to look something like this. Like a nice little communal, tight-knit group of people. We might call it a community. This is your friends, your family, the people to whom you're committed. Might call this the tribal model. Right? Indeed, in the ancient context, this potential answer to who is my neighbor would be precisely the one that says, well, when it says love your neighbor, this is like our tribe, we love the people around us, and presumably the parts of the law that have to do with people outside the tribe are the ones that specifically talk about being about people outside the tribe. And this might be one of the answers that the lawyer actually has in mind when he asks this question. The benefit of thinking about the love of neighbor this way is that it's intimate, it's relational. There's a depth in this model because love is grounded in relationship and a history of mutuality. This is kind of a very communal understanding. The downside, of course, is that it's exclusive, and there are these others there that are excluded. You don't have to worry about loving them. They're not your neighbors. They're not right next door. They're not in your kind of in-group. Presumably, this is the answer that the lawyer is looking for. He's hoping that like these excluded people exist such that he doesn't have to worry about loving them and can say, yes, Jesus, I have indeed loved my neighbor. And we've all seen and perhaps experienced the pain that such exclusivity can cause, especially when we're on the outside looking in. The degree that tribal communities of love can like care for and support their members is often matched only by their ability and the degree to which they can harm outsiders. On the other hand, if we think about neighbor simply being in the sense of other, like love just anybody else as yourself, then we expect the scope of love of neighbor to look something more like this, a kind of vast expanse of all humanity, perhaps dizzying in its immensity and in its scope. This we might call the universal model. And whereas the other one had a very kind of like exclusive kind of cast, this one, the main benefit is very, very inclusive. Everyone is accorded equal treatment under this model. Our liberal intuitions are assuaged. But there is a downside to this model. It's related to, of course, the plus side of the other model, which is that while this is a very inclusive model, this one can be very diffuse and sometimes anonymous. There's just so many people that we just necessarily kind of end up interacting in a much less personal kind of way. The abstraction of love of neighbor to love of humanity is a dangerous one, as a fictional Russian doctor famously explains in The Brothers Karamazov. I'll read you a little bit of this. He says, "I love mankind, but I am amazed at myself. The more I love mankind in general, the less I love people in particular. That is, individually, as separate persons. In my dreams," he said, "I often went so far as to think passionately of serving mankind and would really have gone to the cross for people if it were somehow suddenly necessary. And yet I am incapable of living in the same room with anyone even for 2 days. This I know from experience. In 24 hours, I can begin to hate even the best of men. One because he takes too long eating dinner, another because he has a cold and keeps blowing his nose. I become the enemy of people the moment they touch me," he said. "On the other hand, it has always happened that the more I hate people individually, the more ardent becomes my love for humanity as a whole." Extreme though this guy's case might be, I think probably there's a little bit in us that can identify with this guy's predicament. The universal scope of love of humanity can be eclipsed by its ironic dehumanizing of that very love. So I think if we really understand what this lawyer is asking Jesus, we're left in a double bind. And this is why I think it's a good question. Love, it seems, must be particular in order to be meaningful, but it must be universally offered in order to remain true to its name. This question, who is my neighbor, seems like a particularly relevant and pressing question. And of course, in response, Jesus tells this story that we just read about this guy beaten and left for dead on the side of the road. The question the lawyer has asked Jesus, as we're reading this story, this question has us directed in the following way. Who is obligated to this man as his neighbor, right? He's asked the question, who is my neighbor? So Jesus is going to tell a story, and presumably the question we're trying to focus on is, who is obligated to this guy? This is a guy who might be very inconvenient to be this guy's neighbor, right? So we want to get a sense, is this guy my neighbor? Because the road, you see, is a dangerous place to stop and try to help this man out, right? It's in the middle of nowhere. Who knows that the guys who like beat him up in the first place aren't waiting in the bushes to take out the first guy who stops and helps? Certainly only a person who is obligated to help this guy is actually, who's obligated to this man as his neighbor is going to stop and take the risk. So who will it be? The priest, the Levite, both men who share national and religious identities with the man in need? Is this man their neighbor? Of course, we already know where this is going. These two men pass by, and instead it is the Samaritan who stops and helps. The Samaritan, you see, could probably make the best case that this Judean was certainly not like his neighbor in any kind of communal sense. Jews and Samaritans were enemies, and the injured man is not someone to whom he is obligated. Not a guy to whom he is obligated by any kind of communal connection. But Jesus says, the reason, the fact that you're thinking this way means that you're asking the wrong question. Notice that when Jesus summarizes this story, he turns the question on its head. No longer is it who is obligated to this man as neighbor, rather it is who showed himself to be a neighbor to this man. The question, I think, is not who is my neighbor, but instead it becomes to whom can I be a neighbor? The question is not to whom am I obligated to love, but rather to whom can I obligate myself in love? And just as the Samaritan inverts this original question of the lawyer, so too are two original answers to that question kind of like rendered totally different. What can we say about the tribal versus the universal understandings of love of neighbor in light of the Samaritan's actions? After all, in the story, the Samaritan, who is the injured man's neighbor only in the most universal sense, becomes the man's neighbor in the most intimate sense. He treats him like family. He puts him on his own horse. He takes him to an inn and sets up a tab that he promises to come back and pay. This is not love of humanity in general. This is love of a person, a real individual whom society had said was his enemy. This is what happens, Jesus says, when the question is no longer, who is my neighbor, but instead, to whom can I be a neighbor? No longer, whom must I love, but instead, whom can I dare to love? And I think if the questions start to shift, so too does the neat set of answers that we thought we could give. We've solved our double bind. In the end, Jesus says neither love everyone indiscriminately, anonymously, or in general, but neither does he say love your friends or your community exclusively. Rather, he gives us a challenge. See whom you can dare to invite into intimate community life. See how expansive you can dare to be in loving people. The parable of the Good Samaritan makes it clear that love has a universal scope. We're called to love in an unbounded world like this one. But the goal is not love of humanity in general. Rather, the goal is invitation to relationship. To named, known kind of love. It's an invitation to a community, surely, but rather it's a community whose boundaries are porous, whose orientation is towards those who are outside of it, and who, even as they are established, can continue to pursue people and to invite them in and to chase those folks down in the places where they are. It's a community that's oriented towards taking the risk to go out and reach the other neighbor, even in the most distant place, in the most dangerous place, the most vulnerable place. And perhaps Jesus' greatest proof that this is the kind of loving that we ought to pursue is in the way that he shifts the focus of the story. Hey, stick with me here. You see, I think the way that the lawyer posed his question, Jesus' story should work differently, right? The lawyer's question is, all right, I'm supposed to love my neighbor. Who is my neighbor? The kind of story that would answer this question quite straightforwardly would be not one guy injured and three guys deciding whether to help him, but rather one guy walking by three different kinds of injured people figuring out which of them is his neighbor that he has to help. Does this make sense? Right? That's the appropriate story if Jesus kind of was okay with the question. But instead, Jesus changes the story. And so instead we have this thing where all of a sudden our perspective is shifted from that of the folks making the kind of good ethical decision. And rather, instead we have the perspective of the man who's desperately in need of their help. This one guy whom we meet first, who falls into the hands of these robbers, and then we hear the story more or less from his point of view. At the end of the story, then, what we've experienced is undeniable. If we're the man dying on the side of the road, then we certainly want a world full of good Samaritans rather than priests or Levites. This is good, because if Jesus had told the story the other way around, we might really quickly figure out that it would be a lot easier to be in a world as priests and Levites than as good Samaritans. Right? But Jesus switches our perspective so we have a chance to see this. And I think this makes good sense. A world in which people are passionately pursuing being like the Good Samaritan, a world in which people are asking themselves the question, to whom can I be a neighbor, is a world with a system that works best for the vulnerable, for the most vulnerable. And I think that just, you know, something that are just these freebies that show up. Let me just suggest that to you as a decent kind of kingdom rule. The system that works best for the most vulnerable is usually the best system. And the rule of love that best serves the most vulnerable is the one that dares us day by day to risk to love intimately those to whom we are related only by the most universal of connections. Common humanity, common status as creations of God. Again, not who is my neighbor, but to whom can I be a neighbor? Whom can I dare to love, dare to invite into relationship, into a community of friends? To whom can I dare to lead my community? In whose direction could we dare to walk together? I think the community that is asking this kind of question, I think that is the kind of community that God's inviting us to be in ECV. A close and supportive, yet open and ever-expanding community of love. That's what a community of people following Jesus will have to look like. And I'm sure we've all experienced the kind of that this is the kind of community that we actually prefer to encounter. A couple of summers ago, as I had a chance to share before, Hannah and I spent a couple months in Ghana. We were in residence at a theological institute in the south, but we had a chance while we were there to travel around with a man who had pretty quickly like become our very good friend, Dr. John Azuma. He's a professor of actually Islamic studies at the Theological Center. And he was from the north. And so a couple weeks into our visit, our time in Ghana, he came to us and said, I have to go on a trip up to the north, the other end of the country. This is a good chance for you. You are Westerners. You'll never have a chance to see this much of the country unless you kind of go with someone. Why don't you come with me? Turns out this is a personal errand that this guy's on. He's going to visit a sick relative up in Ouagadougou, the capital in Burkina Faso, actually, you know, across the border. But he invites us along. And the whole way on this trip, everywhere we go, we are his, oh, this is Matt and this is Hannah. They are my dear, dear friends. Introduced everywhere. And because he is Dr. John Azuma, and actually it's interesting there, doctor was not the big deal. He was pastor. Osofo, right? So much honor accorded to him, and all transferred to us because we were his dear, dear friends going back days. And so when we finally got up to the north, we actually came to the village in which John was raised, and we came to this kind of set of buildings. His parents had since passed away, but his brother was still living there. By the way, Caleb, we're going to get to a point here where we're going to want some audio from the computer. You're on it. So we get to this place, and his brother, John's brother, comes out to greet us. And I don't know if John had told him ahead of time who we were, or you know, or maybe it was just his instinct. His brother comes out, oh, you are so welcome here. Thank you so much for coming and blessing our house, for being here with us. And you know, what can we do for you? Come sit down here. Take. We have gifts for you, especially one particular gift that I will let Hannah tell you about if technology does not fail us. Indeed, that was John Azuma actually laughing in the back. That's not me. That was John laughing. And indeed, as Hannah said, Hannah, as you could see, was very proud and very amused by this chicken. Actually, it was crazy for travel for us to like take it back. After we decided we really can only take one chicken. Like, thank you very much. We can really only travel with one. They said, well, okay, if you're going to be traveling back to where you're staying with it, here is a plastic bag. They put the chicken in the plastic bag, tied the little bag around its neck so its little head was sticking out, and then we put it in the van that we were traveling with. you know, on the floor like a bag of groceries, not thinking about this poor live chicken who started like rolling. Anyway, it was really quiet. This poor chicken. That's why Hannah had taken it out of the bag. It had little stripes on the side. It's how it got its name, Tiger Chicken. And as it turned out, actually, that name was very appropriate. That very night when we got back to the guest house when we were staying, it started a huge fight with the other chickens in the coop, which meant that when we were going to eat it for dinner the next night, Tiger Chicken was served at lunch the following day because he just couldn't be trusted in the coop for any longer. This was an extraordinary gift, a substantial sharing of wealth. I forgot, this is Hannah proudly holding Tiger Chicken. It was a really meaningful expression of these folks' love for and acceptance of Hannah and I, whom they didn't know at all. For what it's worth, I think this is probably the third term that's missing for us, but present certainly in the ancient culture in which Jesus was living, and in many contemporary cultures the world over, that is the role of guest, right? Those of you who've lived elsewhere in the world may have really, you know, kind of good memories of this kind of third role that's kind of missing. I would say honored guest, except that I think that misses precisely the point, right? Which is what's missing for us is the societal rule that says that the role of other is in fact a role that necessarily carries with it a large amount of honor and respect that obligates us and invites us to welcome, to love, to dare to treat with privilege the one who comes from outside. So I think a community of people who are following Jesus will have to be a community that loves and honors those outside of it, that dares to go out to those folks outside of the community and invite them in. And that will mean, of course, that there will be challenges. As in Jesus' parable, there will be ethnic, economic, racial, educational, and other social barriers to be traversed in daring to be a true community of love. Yet if we are a community of people following Jesus, we will need to commit to those different than us, not just on ideological grounds, but commit to them as actual people. As at least potential members of our community, we will need to dare to love them as insiders, invite them in, let them teach us and challenge us, even as we offer them Jesus' invitation to come and follow him. But the real, actual, human encounter is irreducible. This past Tuesday, a group of us got together to watch A Time for Burning, which is a documentary about a group of churches, both black and white, in Omaha, Nebraska in the 1960s, who were trying to follow Jesus in racial reconciliation. The film, which, by the way, I found out you can watch on, it's available ad-supported on YouTube. It's kind of a weird thing to watch with ads in the middle of, I don't know, go to the public library and rent the DVD, or borrow the DVD. But the film brought up lots of questions for us. But one statement in particular rang in our ears at the end of the film. And I want to show you a very short clip from the documentary in which they're talking about how to deal with white folks who are not yet ready to move forward in integration. It's like 45 seconds. The statement that I especially want us to reflect on is right at the end, but we can get this started here.
I don't think we can spare them from the tension and the conflict.
Well, we will have tension, but how do we take care of these who are not yet ready to go along with us? This is a concern, and I think we have to face up to this in our churches. How do we as churchmen now minister to these particular people to help them? Because we don't want to lose them. If we lose them, we can't even minister to them at all.
This one lady said to me, Pastor, she said, I want them to have everything I have. So I'm like, God to bless them as much as he blesses me.
places, Pastor, I just can't be in the same room. It just bothers me. How are you going to change this one? I can't sit there and do this sermon.
Sorry, the next person jumps in the conversation right there. I want them to have everything I have. But Pastor, I just can't be in the same room. Seems like the 19th century Russian doctor's predicament has found expression in the heart of a 1960s Midwesterner. In the abstract, I want the best for these folks. I want God's blessing. I want God's best. But to be in the same space, to open up my community to them, or to dare to venture into their community, I just can't do that. I become the enemy of people the moment they touch me, I believe, were that fictional doctor's words. Our conversation after the film on Tuesday quickly turned towards perhaps the obvious question: who are those whom we are afraid to touch, lest we have to admit that they are our enemies? Who are we more comfortable loving in the abstract than in the particular? My hunch is that's probably true of all humans. We're probably better at loving them in the abstract than in reality. And certainly, let it be said that the story of racial reconciliation is far from over in this country or in this city. And as God calls us to be a community of love, that call also contains an invitation to dare to build bridges across persisting racial and ethnic barriers, to speak honestly with one another, to hear one another's stories, and to stand with one another. Yet there will certainly be other challenges to dare to love across boundaries established by educational opportunities and experiences, challenges to dare to love across boundaries of class, of economic status, challenges to dare to love across boundaries of sexual identity, challenges to dare to love across boundaries of political ideology, whether liberal or conservative. And frankly, most generally, the challenge is to dare to love across boundaries established just simply by a lack of shared experience. Simply to love the stranger, the new person, as one invited and welcomed into this community and into our lives personally and individually. The challenge in every case is a challenge to dare to pursue those outside our community in love and in peace. The challenge is to pursue with passion the question Jesus asks in this parable: to whom can I be a neighbor? A few weeks ago, I challenged us as a community to invest in what God is building here at ECV, and one of the first and maybe the most practical ways that I suggested doing that was simply to welcome and gather people. So I put the question that I put to you the other day, I put it to you again. God's challenge is to love your neighbor as yourself. We've seen today the scope and the nature of that challenge. So let's make it specific. To whom can you be a neighbor at your school, in your workplace, in your neighborhood, here at ECV, in our city? Whose path do you cross every day? How can you dare to invite these people into your networks of relationship, into your networks of love? How can you dare to venture into their communities, into their networks, into the places that they call home? How can you take a risk to open your life to them, to love them in particular, not just in general? Like, this kind of love is much of what it looks like to invite people to follow Jesus, and it sure is central to what it means for us to be people who are trying to follow him ourselves. I think this is not the only time this happens in Scripture. When you get at first a law, a rule, love your neighbor. And you get a lawyer asking good legal questions. All right, if I'm going to love my neighbor, who's my neighbor? Let's parse this. And Jesus frustrates that whole kind of legal orientation and instead gives us just like an inclination of the heart, right? This is not an answer that you can chase down. Like, mathematically, this answer doesn't work, right? Like, be in intimate relationship with everyone. That is not the point, right? This is an orientation of the heart to say, I'm not going to be asking who's in, who's out. I'm not going to be asking about my obligations. I'm going to be seeing whether I can orient my heart towards the people around me. I just think that's the kind of person I want to be. That's the kind of people that I want us to be as a church. So let's pray.